APIs embedded within your web app that you want to use both with cookies and with JWT tokens. I maintain this is a really bad idea. If you have an external API that you want to use JWT tokens with, host it outside your app that uses cookies. It's what Google does. If you look at Google's Gmail API, the API that third parties get to call is entirely different to the API that is called from within Gmail itself, because you have external entities and a bunch of trust boundaries and a bunch of other stuff and different authentication schemes. But some people like to do this. You make me unhappy when you do, but I'm sure you don't actually care. So you can limit the authentication scheme for your controller or for your controller methods by using the active authentication schemes property and stick bearer on it. So you could limit something to JWT and it would ignore the cookie stuff that has come down. So I mentioned data protection because that's how we encrypt and sign our cookies. How many of you have accidentally checked in a web.config into GitHub that has contained your machine key? I see one person who's being honest. I'm sure, two or three people are being honest. The rest of you are liars. Because I go to GitHub every now and again, and I search for web.config, and I look for machine keys, and it makes me sad. Let me explain to you why this is bad. If I have your machine key, it is the sole encryption and signing key for cookie authentication. So now I can pretend to be who I want on your website, which is fun. If you are using web forms, actually, how many of you are still using web forms? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. If you are using web forms, it is also the signing key or the encryption key or both for view state. And view state is basically binary serialization. And if I have that key, I can deserialize a bunch of objects that you were never expecting. And I can have remote code execution on your website, which is nice. So machine key sucks. And it's really hard to change, especially when you're in a web farm environment, because you have to change them all at once, and that never works. So we kind of threw it away. We have an entire new data protection stack, and we have a compat layer as well, so you can use this within your .NET 4.6 apps, if you like. I would strongly suggest looking at that, especially for you people that are still stuck on web forms. So we generate keys automatically for you. We rotate the keys every 3 months by default. It is scalable. It provides isolation based on your apps. It provides isolation based on purposes. We try and figure out where to store the keys based on your platform, but there are other options. You can actually write your own key stores if you want to shove them into SQL. And if you are Russian, we can support your strange Russian encryption system that the Russian security services say you must use. We do not provide you with an implementation of that because just no. But you can hook in your own one. So data protection is a bit of a shock for people when they first see it, and they're like, okay, well, our security people want to know what your defaults are, and they are there, and that will make your security people very, very happy. You can kind of change them if you want. But we provide some key stores by default. If you're running an Azure web applications, we put them in a special magic folder that flows between all the instances of your application. However, if you are using slots, they don't give us anything that will allow me to synchronize the keys between slots. So if you're doing A-B testing, people will get logged out, which is not useful. So we have other places to put things. You can stick them in Azure Key Vault. You can stick them in Azure Blob Storage. If you're running on IIS locally, we will stick them in the registry. If you're running an IIS with a user profile, we stick them in the app data directory for that user, and we protect them appropriately. You can store them in memory if you want and throw them away afterwards, which is actually perfectly fine unless you want to use data protection to protect your own data and shove it in a database, at which point you better hope that your keys are stored somewhere that you can reload them from. And they're protected using a bunch of stuff. You can use DPAPI or DPAPING on Windows, X59 or certificate. And then if you just don't care about life or you want to live dangerously, you can store them in plain text. So you can use this manually. It's all hooked into our DI system, so you can just take an IData protection provider in your constructor for whatever class you want that comes from DI, and it will get passed through automatically, and you can call protect and unprotect, and we do everything for you. We do not just encrypt. We encrypt and then we sign with an authenticated signature, because encrypting without an authenticated signature is bad. You can go and look at padding Oracle attacks on the internet, and you can see some very clever mathematics, and it will show you that if you just encrypt without then also adding a signature, people can start decrypting your data without knowing the key, which is a bit scary. So here's how you call it manually, and it's all very exciting. We have purpose strings, so if you are going to call this manually, you should have a purpose. Purpose of, say, authentication cannot protect any data that's being protected with a purpose of data. It's quite nice. Don't use user input for that, because that would be silly. And we recommend that you just do a full namespace with a version as part of your purposes, so when you update your classes, you can change the purpose, and you've still got that isolation, and things will not go badly wrong. Data protection is really well documented, because the developer that wrote it gave me a OneNote file with 60 pages of his thoughts and his reasonings behind every decision that he made, and I just turned that into documentation without much thought. So you can actually see the decisions that we made and why we did stuff, and then all the extension points. It's very impressive, and I will take credit for it, because he never wants to appear on stage for me. So it's my documentation, and I'm wonderful. Here's how you configure it. This one's persisting keys to the file system and doing stuff with a thumbprint. It's not very exciting. But you can implement your own key store. I know that sounds scary. You only have to implement two things. Get all elements, which is give me every single key that you know about. And here's a new key. Store it. And that's it. So on .NET Desktop, we allowed X5 and 9 certificates. We did not have enough support in 1.0. In .NET Core 2.0, yes, you can now finally use certificates to protect your keyring, and you should. Or, if you're running in Azure, you can use Key Vault. The way these things work is we have a store where your keys are stored, and then we have a protector that can run on any type of store. It doesn't really matter. So Key Vault is a protector. It uses a master key inside Key Vault that then wraps and unwraps the keys that we generate, and it's all very fancy and very, very clever. And it only takes one key in Key Vault, which keeps it underneath the free tier for using Key Vault, which is important for all of us because we don't like to pay for things. So, authorization. How are we doing on time? When did I start? Ooh, I still have 20 minutes. Okay, we can get through this. Authorization changed in .NET Core a lot. How many of you have ever tried to write your own custom authorize attribute? That's way too many people, and I'd like to see. How many of you think you did it successfully? That's a lot less hands. Okay. Yeah, it wasn't the most pleasant experience. So when we moved to Core, I got to design an entire feature. And my entire feature was, I no longer want you to write custom authorization attributes, because it's horrible and it sucks and it goes wrong. So we changed stuff a lot. We now have a way to express your authorization pieces in code without having to write your own custom class. We have requirements and we have requirement handlers. And then we have policies. And a policy is built up of one or more requirements. It says, okay, if this person is going to be authorized, they must fulfill this requirement and that requirement, and then the requirement handlers get called so you can figure out whether someone has passed or not. It's all based on DI. You can add resource-based authorization as well, so you can have, say, for example, pass in a Word document into authorize, and it could pick apart the Word document and look at the author and look at the current user and say, yes, these two people match, so he can edit. And so on and so forth. And you can actually just throw the entire damn thing away and replace the authorization service with something that you want for yourself. Please don't do that. If you got to the point where you need to do that, drop me an email and tell me why the whole policy system does not work for you, because I would far rather that we fix the policy system so you don't have to write your own massive authorization service. There is a workshop on this. It takes about an hour and a half to go through that will guide you from writing your first authorize, looking at a role, all the way up to writing code policies and having multiple handlers and then doing resource-based authorization and then going inside your view and changing how the view looks based on who the current user is. It's well worth doing. Because there are slight differences between 1.0 and 2.0, there are two different branches, so make sure you choose the right branch for the version that you are working on. So I'm going to just switch to a demo. Because no one wants to see slides. Excuse me. See, Edge is much faster to start up than Chrome is for debugging. I have no idea why. All right. So I gave this demo in Antwerp, and I did the most American thing I have ever done, in that I got Belgium and the Netherlands mixed up and used the wrong flag. Because, you know, I've lived in America for 7 years now, as you can see. And obviously all the small European countries have merged together in my mind. So let's hope I've got your flag right. Here we have a simple demo. Imagine you are flying into Charles de Gaulle, and you're being welcomed to Charles de Gaulle. Well, I say welcome, but they're French, so... That joke is so not going to go down in America, because Americans think Paris is romantic. Obviously, they've never been. So, I took my wife there, and she's just wandering around looking at all the nice architecture, and I'm just steering her around all the things on the Paris pavements that you don't want to step in. So she thought it was romantic, and I'm just like, you did not look down. So I have got my three customs lanes. I have got the EU customs lane, I have got the nothing to declare, and I have got the customs inquiries rubber glove thing. So I am going to enter through the arrivals from the EU, and I can go as someone British, because they're still part of the EU right now, despite their attempts. I'm okay, I have both a British and an Irish passport, so I don't care. I can go in as an American, I can go in as you lot, this is the right flag, right? And I can go in as a North Korean. Because why the hell not? So, let's go through. Hello, I am Morten Harket, because that was the most famous Norwegian I could think of. When I was in Antwerp, I had it as Papa Smurf. The amount of booze I got when I got their flag wrong, and I'm like, what have I done? So, we have Morten Harket, and we can sign out, and I can do it as British, because that still works. Hello, Theresa May. You're not going to be Prime Minister for much longer. You may laugh, but you're going to have to deal with Boris. And I'll try it again, and this time I'm going to be Mr. Trump. And no, you cannot go through the arrivals from the EU line, because you are not a member of an EU country. You are probably not even human. You are a big Cheeto cheesy What's it person with fake tans and weird hair.
Remember, this is recorded.
Yeah, I know this is recorded. I have my green card. I have it set up, so all I need to do is scan it, so I never talk to any customs agents. It's great. So, we will take a look at a little bit at the code behind this. Eventually, when it's the... Oh, yes, because that's the only drawback from Edge. It doesn't tell me when Edge has stopped. So I have a customs lane requirement. I've set my custom lanes up. It's an EU, nothing to declare, goods to declare. And so I've got a parameterized requirement, and then I've got a handler for that requirement. So I can just look at the country for a person's passport, and then look at the lane they're coming through. And for the EU, I'm going to say, if you're part of the EU, you have succeeded the requirement. Everyone can go through goods to declare, and everyone can go through nothing to declare. So the EE1 is interesting because it runs off to a repository that I'm injecting into my handler. So you can now run off to databases during authorization. There's no database here, of course, because I'm lazy. My repository just has here. So now we go Brexit. So my database is changing, but my policy is not. I run this again. Dum-de-dum-de-dum. So I'm going to enter again. And this time I'm going to say I'm British. And no, I cannot go through because Britain has gone through Brexit and I've changed my database. So we have a flexible authorization service where you express absolutely everything in code. And hopefully that removes the need for you to write your own custom authorized attributes. Now that is a quick run through. That is not a particularly complicated example. You can do really complicated things. I strongly advise you go through the workshop. It's been written and honed over the last year and a half. I've even taken pull requests for spelling mistakes. But it is only for authorization. Please don't ask me authentication questions on that workshop, because my response will be, this is only for authorization. I will eventually get round to writing an authentication workshop when someone asks me to do an authentication workshop at a conference. So, requirements are quite simple. You basically implement iAuthorization requirement. Nothing more. There are no methods to implement. There are no properties to implement. You don't have to do anything. I have a parameterized version in my sample, which is nice because it's lazy. I don't have to have multiple requirements. And then you write a handler for your authorization requirement. And it has a single method, which is handle requirement. And you just do what you want in it. If someone has passed your requirement, if the current user has passed, you call context.succeed. And that's it. That's all you have to do. And then you build policies like this. In your add authorization, you call options.addPolicy, you give it a name, and then you add all the requirements that you want for your policy. And they're cumulative, so you have to pass every single requirement. And then you register the handlers for each requirement. This is being lazy, so it's a singleton. It doesn't have any database access, but you can add it as scoped or whatever you like based on how you're going to write your handler. And then with authorize, there is a new attribute, and you just specify your policy, and it runs magically. The little authorization pixies do stuff, and lo and behold, hopefully it works. I've done my demo. Go away. So, the complicated thing that takes people a little bit to get around is, you know, policies are made up of one or more requirements. Every single policy must pass. But even if a previous one has failed, we are going to evaluate every single policy that you have, or every single requirement that you've put in your policy, because you may be logging stuff. Your policies or your requirements may have side effects, so we're going to run every single one. We don't short circuit. And requirements may have multiple handlers. If you've ever been to a Microsoft office, you will see people wandering around with badges and badging themselves in and out. So if we take a Microsoft Office building entry requirement, there are a few ways to do it. You may have your badge, and you tap it, and in you go. That is one example of a handler for that requirement. But another handler may be that you are wandering around with the temporary badge of shame, which has a really bad black and white picture of you because you left your badge at home. So that's another way to fulfill that requirement. So now we have two handlers. Or you may be a guest that is being escorted, so now we have three handlers for a single requirement. And if any of those handlers succeed, then that requirement has been fulfilled. Just don't forget to register them in your DI system, otherwise everything fails. If you think something should be passing and you've written a policy, you have probably forgotten to put your handler in DI, which I do all the time, which is why I don't do these demos live on stage. So we have context.succeed, and that leads to you automatically thinking we have context.fail, and that is true. But I don't want you to use it. Context.succeed is when your requirement has been fulfilled. But remember, if you have multiple handlers, another handler may have the ability to say context.succeed. So if your individual handler can't fulfill the requirement, do nothing, just return. Context.fail is there for the rare occasions where you want to short circuit everything and say, no matter what, this needs to stop. So it's like, my database is on fire, don't do anything else, or David Fowler's made another security mistake, don't let him in the building for 24 hours. No one will ever let me away with that. So context.fail is just the most severe action possible. And it says, even if any other handlers fulfill the requirements, I don't care. I need this to stop. So it is the someone has just been fired option. You can also call this in code. You can take an iAuthorization service because we're all DI friendly. And then you can call authorize async. And then if failed, you can return a challenge response or do whatever you want. Resource-based authorization. You're just passing in a document. It's just another parameter. So here we have an authorization handler. And whereas before it would have the requirement, just the requirement, now it has the requirement and the resource type that I want to check. So here we have my canonical, well, I've got a Word document. I'm going to look at the owner of the Word document. And if the owner is the same, then my requirement has been fulfilled. You can turn on authorization everywhere with that. Don't forget to then say allow anonymous on your login page and your logout page and your error pages. Otherwise, everything gets stuck in an infinite loop, and it's really funny. And like I say, you can also limit your authentication scheme. You can put it in a policy here rather than just doing it in the authorize attribute. And you can do things in views. You can actually inject the authorization service into a view and call authorize async with the policy name in your view and then hide or show certain things in your UI. Some people don't like that. Some people think you should do it beforehand and then pass the appropriate flags in your view models. I'm kind of agnostic on this. I honestly don't care. But if you are checking in views, remember to duplicate the checks in your controllers because otherwise someone will just type the darn URL in and if you've only done the check in your views, they're going to get in, which is what I do to interns every year. We have interns every year, and they get to write some code, and then they get told they're having a security review of their code, and every single one of them just does the check in the view. They don't then duplicate it in the controller behind the scenes. So don't do that. Don't be an intern. You can have custom policy providers and yada, yada, yada. There's backcompat stuff, which I've talked about. It's basically data protection pieces, so you can share cookies between Katana-based applications in ASP.NET Core. It's not really backcompat. It's dragging 4.5 forwards to use the new formats and the new data protection stuff. We have some miscellaneous enhancements. All the encoders are based on Cichlids. The encoders are in DI, and you can inject stuff. You can make CSRF automatic if you want. You have to be using very simple websites for that. You can try it, see if it works for you. If you're going to use bearer tokens, it's never going to work for you. But some people like it. We've got Core's middleware, and we have the environment stuff, which will default to release. So if you have set configuration up that is based on environment, remember that your default environment is always release, because that way we don't have yellow screens of death with full stack traces on machines that are exposed to the internet. So that's how to just move stuff around. We have a secret manager, which is basically for development time only. And basically, oh, look at that. I have 3 minutes, which for a European audience is probably enough to get one question out of you, because it's like dragging blood out of a stone. So I don't actually mind. It's fine. I mean, you're not whooping and cheering like Americans, which is the most off-putting thing ever. Does anyone who is not American, because we have a couple sitting down here, does anyone who's not American have a question? Wow, I was right. That's why I like just blathering for the entire hour, because I'm never gonna get a question out of it. That's absolutely fine. Thank you very much for coming. I know this has been fast.